The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
David Sachs is a journalist whose work has appeared in New York Magazine, GQ, Vanity Fair, and the Huffington Post, but his true passion is pastrami and his true calling is corned beef. He spent the better part of 3 years traveling throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe, visiting over 150 delis, documenting the decline of his beloved Jewish delicatessen. His new book, Save the Deli, is a campaign to preserve the traditions, the culture, and most importantly, the food that has been passed down through generations and that is now on the verge of extinction. From New York to Montreal to Detroit to Los Angeles, David Sachs has tasted his way through the delis that remain, finding the best rye bread, matzo balls, blintzes, brisket, and knishes that this endangered species has to offer. Part history lesson and part travelogue, Save the Deli is one man's journey to celebrate his cured and salted culinary heritage and a heartfelt plea to keep a once great culture alive for future generations. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. David Sachs.
Love. Here we go. There we go. Everyone hear me? Thank you, Jeff. Jeff was going to mention actually today that today is International Sandwich Day. It's the Earl of Sandwich's birthday. So this is a really appropriate occasion. But I'm going to start off with a bit of a story. I called my good friend Christopher Farber, who's a photographer that took the picture on the cover of the book. Oh, somewhere. Someone has a book. And he lived in Philadelphia for a number of years. And I said, listen, man, why don't you come down from New York today and come out and see the thing? We'll hang out. I got a big hotel room. I'll throw you on the floor or whatever. And he says, no, there's no way I'm going to this talk. And I'm like, why? He's like, this crowd is going to hate you. I said, what do you mean this crowd is going to hate me? And he said, you know, they're really not going to like you in Philly. I'm like, you know, I know I live in New York, but I'm from Toronto. I have no allegiance to any baseball team. Go Phillies. And I certainly know that Toronto Maple Leafs aren't any contender for anything for the next 30 years, so it can't be Flyers fans. He's like, you're going to have to explain to the third largest Jewish community in the country why you didn't include them in this book, why Philadelphia doesn't get a chapter. So I'm going to preempt all your angry questions with this, with a mea culpa. I'm sorry. And it wasn't because Philadelphia doesn't have great delis, because it clearly does. And it wasn't because Philadelphia isn't a town with a strong deli culture and a love of sandwiches, because it clearly is. It owns, you know, a number of sandwiches to its name. It was because I just ran out of time when I was doing research for the book and I ran out of money. So I'm very sorry. And, you know, I'm going to say the same thing when I went to Baltimore and when I go to Boston and these other places. I'm sorry I didn't get Philly into the book. But the book is really about Jewish delicatessen culture everywhere. And so the things I talk about in the book apply just as much to Philly as they do to New York, as they do to Los Angeles, as they do to London, England, and Paris. And it's really the story about the Jewish delicatessen business and why we need to save the Jewish deli. So two things. Let's find out why exactly the delicatessen needs saving and then why we should save it. Just a bit of history for everybody. The Jewish delicatessen is not something that originated, you know, and plopped down on America's shores. It wasn't something that we found in Poland 300 years ago. It's kind of this amalgam of Eastern European Jewish cooking, Yiddish cooking, and, you know, the American restaurant. When the Temple of Israel and biblical Israel was destroyed in 70 CE, the Jews were expelled from the land of Israel, and they went in two directions, in two sort of groups. The Sephardic Jews went, oh, it sounds much better back here, doesn't it? The Sephardic Jews went all around the Mediterranean basin and what became the Arab countries in Spain and Portugal. And the Ashkenazi Jews eventually found their way into northern and eastern Europe. They sort of coalesced as a group in and around the border of France and Germany, and then later lived in Poland and Russia and Galicia, Romania, Hungary, Russia, did I say? Anyway, all the different countries, you know, in towns and cities and shtetls and so forth. And that period of time, basically from the 12th century right up until the Holocaust, they were spread out in small communities and in cities, but it wasn't one sort of block. They lived in their own sort of small places, and they moved constantly from kingdom to kingdom or country to country as new rulers came in and said, oh, well, this is all the fault of the Jews, or this is the fault of the Jews, and you know, pogroms and different purges moved them along. And as they moved along, they went from place to place, and they adapted what was the local food to kosher norms. So they went to Poland, and they saw that the Poles were eating a breakfast sausage called kiszki, which was made from pig's blood and buckwheat and stuffed in a pig intestine, which is, you know, the least kosher thing you could ever eat. And so they said, well, what can we do that's sort of like this? Let's, you know, take beef intestine and stuff it with schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat and matzo meal. And so that's how you get the kishka that you find in the Jewish delicatessens. And you know, the Russian little meat pies, piroshki, became the knish or pirogan. And all these sort of foods coalesced into Yiddish cooking. But it wasn't a delicatessen. You know, the word delicatessen is a French-German word, and it basically means delicious things to eat, and it's a store that sells mostly preserved meats and other prepared goods. So, you know, the Jews had in their own little shtetls and towns and cities and communities in Europe their own sort of delicatessens, place where you could buy a salami or a hot dog and these sorts of things that were made in the local style. But we fast forward to the 1880s. And the Russian Tsar changes. There's a change of power. The old Russian Tsar is assassinated. The new Russian Tsar blames it on the Jews. And so he enacts a thing called the May Laws. The May Laws are the extremely harsh anti-Semitic laws, which say that, you know, Jews can no longer hold property. Jews can't work in the following fields. Doctors, law, I know, it was every mother was crying. Jews can live only in within certain areas. Jews can't live within cities. It was terribly harsh, restrictive laws that was meant to crush and stifle a community, which it did. So you have millions of Eastern European Jews leaving Eastern Europe. And they mostly come to the United States and mostly to New York, which was the largest port. Between 1880 and, you know, the 1920s, when the immigration laws were suddenly restricted, you have some 2 million-odd Eastern European Jews coming to the United States and really mostly settling at one point and another, not just in New York, but within about 2 square miles of Lower Manhattan, what's known as the Lower East Side. So suddenly these communities, which are all disparate communities, are living literally on top of another in tenements. You know, in one apartment you have the Goldbergs, who are from Russia. In the next apartment you have the Frankowitzes, who are from Hungary. In the next apartment over you have the Kishkisteens, I'm literally making this up, who are from Warsaw. And everybody's kind of mingling together. And the smells from one apartment, the recipes are wafting over to another. And people, of course, are selling the food in push carts on the street that they sell to the garment workers. They're opening up their own butcher shops, and they're carrying their own sort of things. And slowly, all these different cuisines begin to coalesce into one cuisine, which becomes the delicatessen, which sort of gets all the different meat dishes. Remember that milk and meat are separate in kosher law. All the different meat dishes into one sort of place. And with each successive generation, within a couple of years, it becomes goes from, you know, push carts to butcher shops to brick and mortar restaurants. And that's how we get the Jewish delicatessen in really the turn of the century in New York City. And then it spreads, of course, throughout the rest of the country as people moved on and said, all right, forget these Manhattan prices. We're going to Philly. And so that's the basic history of it. So why do we need to save it, right? I mean, it really grew up to this tremendous point where in the 1930s alone, you had thousands of Jewish delis across the country. It had 2,000 plus in New York City alone. Today, just for comparison, there's some 24 in New York City. That's kosher and non-kosher, includes a few glatt kosher places that also serve sushi and barbecue. So, I mean, I'm really stretching the definition of it. That's a tremendous decline, and it's a decline that you see in cities like Chicago and in cities like Boston and cities like Toronto, where I'm from, and yes, even in Philadelphia. And I'm sure many of you who are in the audience who are older than I am, with the exception of that young boy over there, is probably everybody else, is that it probably happened in Philly as well, that you can probably remember the names of dozens and dozens and dozens of Jewish delis that were in Philly, which are no longer here. So the decline is chartered, and anybody can tell you that it happened. And it happened for what I'm going to say is really two reasons, and it continues to happen today. The first is economic, right? Jewish deli is a business. And in any business, you have to make money. You have to make sort of profits. So the majority of people go into a Jewish delicatessen for what? Sandwich. Thank you, whoever yelled out sandwich. You go in for a corned beef sandwich. You go in for a brisket sandwich. You go in for a pastrami sandwich. Some of you might go in for a tongue sandwich, the brave and the knowledgeable, which is great. But as one Jewish deli owner told me, if I sold 6,000 pastrami sandwiches every day for a week, I'd go out of business. That the Jewish delis serve mostly those things, and those things make the Jewish delis the least amount of money. They're going to make about 10 to 15% profit on it. If they're kosher, they're probably going to make even less. It's due to the fact that, you know, this is meat that you have to take fresh meat, which has increased in price dramatically, a brisket or a navel or a tongue. The prices have shot up over the past decades. And you have to then cure it. So you either do it yourself, which takes time and money, or you pay someone to do it, to salt it, to smoke it, to brine it. And then you have to steam it. And in that process, of course, it's going to shrink down. And then you have to have an expert slice it, either by hand, like they do at Herschel's, or on a slicing machine like most other places do it. Again, shrinking it down. You're going to lose about 25% of the weight of that. And then you have to serve it to someone in the sandwich. And that person's going to get it, and they're going to pay $10 for it. Or, you know, if they're in New York, they'll pay $15 for it. And they're going to say, $15 for a corned beef sandwich? You got to be out of your mind. This is crazy. And the fact of the matter is that deli is only going to be making a dollar or two, maybe, out of that sandwich. And so economically, that's really driving them out of business. It's very tough for Jewish delicatessens to make a lot of money on that thing. They're working with very low margins. And, you know, you think of a bar that sells chicken wings. They're going to sell those basket of chicken wings for $11, and it probably costs them $2, and they're going to sell about three pitchers of beer to go with it. You know, who here has ever had a drink in a Jewish deli? Right, no one, exactly. Jews don't really drink in delicatessens. They might drink other places, but it's just not the type of thing you do. So that area where every other restaurant's making a ton of money doesn't work. And the efficiencies that you would get from making it into a fast food, fast service sort of restaurant, right? You know, cutting back on this, processing, and all these sorts of different shortcuts kill Jewish delis. You know, you instantly know when they start microwaving the pastrami, the place has gone downhill, and that's what the chains will do. And so nobody really eats there in their right mind. So that's the economic factor. But what I want to talk a little more about, and what I think is more important and more interesting, is the cultural factor. As I said, this started out as the food of Eastern European Jewish immigrants. You know, Shlomo, or I guess that wasn't such an Eastern European Jewish immigrant name. Let's say Moshe. Moshe comes from Poland, and he settles in, you know, Philadelphia in the 1920s. And, you know, he eats this food every day where in between his shifts of cutting bolts of cloth. And this is what he eats. You know, for breakfast, he has herring and black bread. For lunch, he might have a pastrami sandwich. For dinner, he's going to have kishka or a cabbage roll every day for his entire life. And so you need a lot of delicatessens to serve someone like that. Moshe's kid, Moshe Leh, who he calls himself Mark, is more American. And so, you know, he goes out and he really loves Chinese food. He learns to like pizza. He might keep you know, kosher style, so he's not really ever going to eat pork or shrimp except Chinese food. That's, you know, totally kosher. You know, he broadens out and eats, you know, spaghetti and all these other foods. And once a week or twice a week, you know, when he visits his parents and stuff like that, he's going to eat it. He's going to have Jewish deli, and he's going to go to the deli because he goes with his father and he remembers it, and it's still who he is, right? He grew up in that culture. Mark's kid, Star, or Dakota, they grew up in the burbs. They grew up way in the burbs. They're nowhere even near the city. Been to synagogue once a year. They stop in for 1 hour, take their kids, and they pretty much eat sushi about 7 nights a week. Once a month, once every 2 months, they go visit Zeta, and they go to Murray's or Jaime's, depending on which Zeta it is. And they sort of eat it, but they ask for the corned beef lean. And they, you know, they mainly get turkey. And oh, God, don't even put the chopped liver near me. And tongue, oh, God, I think that comes from an actual tongue. Pause for water. So this is what happens. It just becomes that, you know, with each successive generation of American Jews or Jews in any other country, their connection to the food that they came from, their connection to that culture lessens. So, okay, fine. I mean, this happens with Chinese Americans, and this happens with Mexican Americans, with Italian Americans, but you know, Chinese restaurants are doing great. Mexican restaurants are doing great. Italian restaurants are always doing great, and especially here in Philadelphia. What makes Jews so different? Well, an Italian cook can always go, a chef, and he can fly back to Tuscany and spend 3 months there apprenticing with a butcher, or going around Florence and Milan and Rome and tasting all the different pastas and getting inspiration. A Chinese restaurant will probably open up every week in this city. There are more Chinese restaurants in the United States than there are McDonald's. And that's because there are 1.3 billion people in China. And as long as some of those 1.3 billion people want to come to the United States and those can cook, there are going to always be people coming here and cooking and opening up Chinese restaurants and bringing not just Chinese-American food, but Chinese-Chinese food, authentic, real flavors, undiluted flavors. And there'll be a population of immigrants who come with them to support that. The same goes with Mexican food, right? You know, as long as Jose has a cousin in Pueblo and Jose's cousin Raul comes up and then Raul has another brother who wants to come up as well, there'll always be someone opening authentic Mexican restaurants in cities like Philadelphia. The Jews don't have that. The Nazis destroyed Jewish Eastern Europe. They eradicated the Ashkenazi Jews who were living there. And so within that diaspora of Jews, I am now part of the Ashkenazi diaspora. There are no more Jews from Warsaw and Hungary and Russia who are going to come over and are going to be able to cook this food the way it used to be done. There are no large populations. There are, you know, a scattered few remnants of these communities. So this is a food that is being cooked basically from memory and from history, and that's what makes it so difficult for it to sustain. It's something that's cut off from its source, and that source is gone forever. It was eradicated in the Holocaust, and it's never going to come back, and that's just the sad truth about it. So those are the big reasons, right? Economic and cultural. Why? Why the hell should we save the deli, if that's the case? I mean, as someone always said, if we're moving on to kosher sushi, then that's the future of it. Okay. Again, I see a couple reasons why we should save the deli besides book sales. Here we go. Fingers crossed. One is the food. I wouldn't have done this if I didn't love Jewish delicatessen, and I doubt you folks wouldn't be out here if you love Jewish delicatessen as well. If you didn't love Jewish delicatessen. You know, you go into a Jewish deli, and you might go there for the nostalgia, and you might go there to go with your grandparents, and you might go there because it just sort of feels like, oh, yeah, you know, it's the old-timey sort of thing, and I want that. But you wouldn't go back if it didn't taste great. And the fact of the matter is, you know, a matzo ball soup, a chopped liver, a bisala knish, you know, a pastrami sandwich or a corned beef sandwich or a tongue sandwich are wonderful, delicious things. And that's why I don't just see Jews in this audience, because these are foods that taste great. There's a universal appeal to them. They're not fussy foods. They're not fancy foods. They're not very complicated foods. They're difficult to get really right, and which is why everyone says, I can't get a good this here, I can't get a good that there. And, you know, any deli that someone in this audience likes, there's going to be another person on the other side of the room that says, what are you talking about? You know, Jaime's is terrible, but I think Murray's is great. And on it'll go. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, this is delicious food. So we should preserve it and save it for the flavor, because no one else is going to reproduce it. You know, if the Jewish deli dies, we sure as hell can't leave it up to Subway to save pastrami and corned beef in this world. If any of you have tasted pastrami and corned beef in Subway, you'll certainly agree. The other reason I think it's important to save it is space. The Jewish delicatessen is one of the few places, if not the only place, where you could walk in a goy and come out a Jew. And 10 pounds heavier with a lot of gas. To go into a synagogue, you really need an invitation from someone in the community. You probably need to be able to know at least what the prayers mean. And you know, if it's an Orthodox synagogue or a conservative synagogue, you should know how to read Hebrew. You're going to be an outsider. To become part of the Jewish faith, you, A, have to have a circumcision if you're men, so that cuts out a lot of people, literally. And B, you know, to convert fully, you have to study. I mean, it takes a year of classes and tests. It's very much like the SATs, which is why Jewish mothers are so inclined to push their children to standardized tests. It's very difficult. But anybody from any culture and any race and any background and any religion, with the exception of vegans, can walk into a Jewish delicatessen and have an organic Jewish experience. They can eat Jewish. They can talk Jewish with the waitress and the waiter who are sort of giving them shtick. And it's not, hello, sir, how may I help you? It's, what do you want? Oh, honey, you look great. You know, where are your kids from? That sort of thing. I mean, it's loud conversation. It's an insane experience, but it's part of it. You'll sort of smell garlicky. You'll be perfumed in Eau de Judea. And you'll sort of come out feeling like, yeah, I went to this Jewish deli today, and, you know, I don't know, but I got a little more chutzpah at the end of it. I feel very Jewish, which is great. And for Jews of, you know, a younger generation, the third generation ones who are eating sushi, who don't speak Yiddish and never will, who probably, again, never go to synagogue if they go at least once a year, for them to recharge in their Jewish identity, for them to sort of get the sense that, okay, I know ethnically I'm Jewish because my last name is Hershowitz, which we changed to Hirsch, which we're changing to Harvey next year. But, you know, what makes me do it? It's always said that the dissipation of ethnic identity in America and other countries is first the religion goes, then goes the language, and finally the taste buds go. And so the Jewish deli is our last line of defense against total and complete assimilation. If we can't save the pastrami sandwich or the corned beef, what can we save? That's my spiel. So I want to open it up to questions from the audience. I believe there are some microphones in the back that are coming around. Please raise your hand and I'll call on you, and then I'll call the next person who will get a microphone. Sir in the back, just hold on 1 second. Stand up and the lady will come with the microphone. And then sir in the front, you get the next microphone.
I grew up in a Jewish deli in Winfield many years ago. But my parents never wanted us to go into the deli business. They wanted us to go to college, get an education, and be a professional person. So I think that's a major factor in why Jewish delis are not around today. Another major factor, I believe, is health. I think if you eat Jewish deli food on a regular basis, you wind up with heart disease at an early age. And okay. I think that's a major factor in why they're not doing as well as
okay, so I agree.
I like your comments.
Okay, I agree 100% with your first comment that it's true. The immigrant parents worked, or the children of the immigrants worked very hard to put you through, what, law school, medical school? Where'd you go? Medical school. And we're happy he's a doctor, and we found him a wife, and it's beautiful. Worked very hard to put them, their children through medical school, and they discouraged the kids from opening the business. And that's certainly a major reason why, and I didn't mention it in the interest of time. The health factor as well is something that's, you know, really prevalent in the past 20 years. In the 1980s, you had the cardiologist saying, cholesterol is going to kill you, and all fat is bad. Don't eat any fat whatsoever. So everyone eats boneless, skinless chicken breasts and freaks out and goes to the deli and said, I want everything extra, extra lean. And then all of a sudden they're like, why is the corned beef so dry? Forget it. We're not eating deli anymore. And in the 1990s, you had Atkins who said, you know, bread's gonna make you fat and unattractive. Don't eat any bread. And so people went in and said, can I get my extra lean corned beef between two slices of lettuce? And they're like, God, this deli doesn't taste the way it used to. A lot of that evidence has been refuted by studies in recent years that shows that the overblown fear against fat was again, you know, overblown. It was really exaggerated. And I will tell you a story that, in the beginning of the book, I talk about my grandfather in Montreal, Papa Sam Sachs, who, worked in the garment business and was the, you know, son of immigrants from Romania and grew up eating delicatessen and smoked a lot, was very unhealthy. And he had an angina when he was about 63 and went to the doctor, Dr. Phil Levine in Montreal. And he said, you know, you really got to cut back on the fat and salt. You're eating like five delicatessen meals a week. And, you know, and then you're having three other ones on the side, I can tell. And he's like, okay, this is, you know, you're really lucky to be alive, to go, whew. And he's walking home and he's like, you know, I feel great. I'm lucky to be alive. And he walks by Schwartz's delicatessen and he sees piled high in the window, the smoked meats that they sell in Montreal, which is like a pastrami and speck, which is pickled fat. And he gets a sandwich, a fatty sandwich with fat on top, and he dies of a heart attack about 2 days later. So, you know, you would say it's a cautionary tale, but when I was speaking at Langer's Delicatessen in L.A. the other day, Dr. Phil Levine, my grandfather's cardiologist, the one who told him not to have that, the one who literally pronounced him dead, was there. And, you know, he introduced himself. I met him before. And he said, you know, I'm sorry about that. And I said, well, you know, you're still here eating pastrami. And he goes, of course. You know, if you eat this once a week and you exercise regularly and you have a balanced diet, it's not going to kill you, just as if you eat, you know, a cheesesteak once a week or a hamburger once a week or twice a week or whatever. If you eat Jewish delicatessen three meals a day and you never exercise and you only eat fatty, salty things, yeah, of course, it's not going to be healthy for you. But a little moderation and a little exercise goes a long way. That's what I say to that. Next question. Sir.
Hi. As much as the Jewish deli is disappearing, what's totally been obliterated is the appetizing store. How many did you run into besides Russendorf?
Yeah, the appetizing store is fewer, much fewer and further between. When I cited that initial statistic, there were, you know, thousands of Jewish delis in New York in the 1930s. It was from a study that said there were 1,500 kosher delis, so I added in the non-kosher ones. In that same study, it said in the 1930s that there were some 120 appetizing stores, so or dairy restaurants. So it's always been far fewer. And yeah, you rarely find one. You know, Russ and Daughters and Barney Greengrass are the only ones in New York, and Sables, and in other cities, they're, you know, one if you're lucky. So it's the same factors that went the way of the deli have certainly caused the appetizing store to disappear. Yes, ma'am, up there. Mike's coming. I'm hoping this half of the room's gonna pull its weight. There we go.
My father's from the Bronx, and my mom's from Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn, and my grandmother, her apartment was around the corner from this deli that was maybe as wide as that podium, and I have yet to taste deli as good as any place that I've had deli in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm including bagels. I mean, just everything there was just unreal, and so everything you're talking about I completely understand and agree with. So where have you found it that it just has that taste?
Okay. First of all, to all the old Brooklyn Jews out there, it is never going to taste as good as it did in the 1930s or 50s or 60s in, you know, Flatbush, New York, because you're tasting memory. You know, you're selecting the absolute best flavors in the back of your mind for the sweetest period of your life. And so, you know, if I transplanted you today and put you down blindfold, you might say, oh, yeah, it's okay. But because you're going back into memory and it's chewed up with nostalgia, nothing will ever taste as good as that. You know, I'm going to tell you right now, it will never, ever be that good. So just learn to enjoy what you have. The fact of the matter is I tasted great delicatessen all over the country. I tasted amazing deli in Chicago, incredible deli in Montreal, great deli in Toronto, fantastic delicatessen in Los Angeles, in New York, everywhere, in all these corners. There's great deli out there, and you have to work yourself through the menus and go to different places and explore. Most people here in Philadelphia and other cities pick one deli and they go there all the time, but you may never know that, you know, the Famous or the Kibitz or Rachel's or Herschel's makes a better kishka than the next guy or a better cabbage roll. Not every deli does every single thing perfectly. So go and, you know, eat your way around and see what's sort of good. That's the best I could say. Oh, and you know, buy the book. There's a few tips in there, too, of where to go. Gentleman in the blue shirt there.
Short question. Where'd the tradition of the big, fat sandwich that you have to take half of it home come from?
Okay. The huge sandwich, first of all, comes from the need for security and abundance. The Eastern European Jews didn't have pastrami and corned beef sandwiches. They had methods of preparation that made those dishes, but it wasn't such sandwich culture. And the fact of the matter is they were very, very poor in the shtetl and other places. And so beef was a once-a-year thing. I mean, you had it at a wedding. You had it at you know, Passover, and that was it. You got a little bit of brisket in your chillin' if you were lucky. Suddenly, these people come to the United States, and I mean, literally, briskets and navels are growing on the trees. You know, there's entire vast plains linked by railroad in the middle of the country that are shipping in beef, and beef is cheaper than chicken. Beef is cheaper than goose. So they abandon goose and duck and chicken, which were their main staples, and they start, you know, making these meat dishes, and of course they're going to go insane. I mean, look at any immigrant group. You know, in Toronto, where I'm from, we have a large Somali population, and when you think Somali, you think images of extremely, extremely emaciated, thin people who've been through a famine, and within a generation, their kids are, you know, just as fat as everyone else in this country because the portions just increase. This is what we do in America. We fatten people up. So that's sort of how it came to be, and then later on it became a marketing thing where it was, you know, the Stage Deli in New York had a sandwich that was that big. Then the Carnegie's like, well, we got a bigger one than them. And then it just kind of, these towers of Babel keep going and going until everybody has heart attacks and the good doctor over there makes a decent living. Sir. And then the gentleman behind him after him.
Hi. You talked about the reasons why we should save the deli, as you say, but I would like to hear a little bit more about your ideas about what can be done about saving the delis. And I'll tell you why I'm asking. I'm in the advertising business, and I have a few clients who are in the deli business.
Okay, great. there's no strict prescription to what can be done. I mean, if there was a magic bullet, everybody would, you know, load their gun up and shoot the problem in the head. There are a few things that I discovered. One is that Jewish delis really ought to go back to making as much from scratch as possible. In the post-war era, food production became really industrialized, and it allowed people to sort of get cheaper things. You know, you were making your pastrami, you were curing it and smoking it in your deli, and Hebrew National is offering to do it for $3 less a pound. Well, you know, think of the profits you could make. You'd be foolish not to. What happened is then every single deli in you know, a five-block radius is serving the exact same products. What makes one different from the other? Now I'm seeing in places like Herschel's in the market Famous, right, that's it. You know, these people are making their own corned beef and pastrami, and it's unique. And it's a draw to people because it's a value-added product. It's something that people, one, these days very much appreciate in terms of health. These days it's not so much about low fat. It's really about where does your product come from? Does it come from a plant in Iowa that's injecting and shipping and freezing this stuff with preservatives? Or does it come from a guy who's curing it in the basement of that very deli, who's made it and touched it every step of the way, and it has a unique flavor, and you go there and you know that you can't go to the next deli and get that same product. So that's one sort of thing. You know, other things, I mean, it's again, just a question of feeling what the community has. One of the great things about here in Philadelphia is that the Jewish delis here are Philadelphia delis, especially the late departed Philadeli, which had a great name. They're very much locally owned and operated, and they're also locally focused. What you find in other cities are, you know, we're the New York deli, we're the New York deli, we're the Manhattan deli. They all claim that they're New York, and they bring in their food from New York, and you know, they bring it in from outside, and they decorate the place like it's Times Square gift shop, and it's just trying to capture, again, that nostalgic feeling of Brooklyn, which you're never going to equal because it's never going to be, you know, Flatbush Avenue, 1955 or whatever. So I always say that deli should, you know, focus on where they are and who they are and the communities they're from. The gentleman in the back there.
Thank you. I grew up in the Bronx, but recently I was working in Indianapolis, and I found in the suburbs of Indianapolis Shapiro's Delicatessen, which seemed to have a more diverse population of people attending. I would say that was probably one of the best delicatessens I've been in. Are you familiar with that, and could that possibly be a model for the new age of delicatessens?
Okay, well, it's... Okay. Shapiro's is one of the oldest delicatessens in the country. I think after Katz's, it's the second oldest. It's from 1905. So it's certainly not a new model for a new anything, but it's regarded as one of the best ones. I haven't personally been. Again, it was one of the places I missed on my tour just because of time and resources, but it's supposed to be an excellent place. Ma'am. And then this gentleman here in the front.
I grew up in Atlanta and live there, and I don't know much about delis, but I have an idea, okay? You said that the delis originated from a diversity from the origin where wherever the Jews were living, and they kind of copied the, you know, kind of a version of a Jewish version of whatever. So what if the deli expanded somewhat in their approach and not only had a typical delicatessen, but let's say they also had, you know, a little bit more diverse menu, so that the countries that it originally came from, perhaps you could have, you know, a really authentic German meal or an authentic Russian. I know that sounds like a big load, but it may draw more people in, because if you want large groups, you know, maybe six people don't want corned beef that night, but you might have somebody that wants a different
right.
type.
You saw this a lot, really, when the delis started declining in the 1970s and 80s. The owners were like, well, we really need to diversify. They didn't often do it with Eastern European stuff, but they did it with pizza and with pasta and with hamburgers and cheesesteaks and other sandwiches. You know, I see a few, again, who are doing sushi and who have done Chinese food. What happens is, like with any restaurant, it's very difficult to do the things you do right. If you have a restaurant, you serve 10 items, you know, not all those items are going to be perfect. It's going to take a lot of effort to do those 10 items well. When you branch out in a restaurant, especially an ethnic restaurant, it draws your energy and your effort and your time away from those other things. And it's very difficult to do well. And just in my tasting experience, any of the places that have sort of done that have gone outside of the traditions and tried to bring in order to draw their clientele, end up making crappy Jewish deli and crappy, you know, Russian food or German food, if that were the case. I do think, as part of what the gentleman behind you said, one of the things they could do is dig deeper for inspiration, instead of outside the culture, into the culture. You know, the 30 items that are on a Jewish deli menu, there was far more to Yiddish cuisine than that. And I tasted a lot of it in France, where I had, you know, not just one type of salami, the Hebrew national basic, but 10 different types, some the size of the tip of your finger, some the size of baseball bats, some with hazelnuts in them, some made with duck fat and goose and veal, and all these artisanal, wonderful, slow-cured things that you would find like in an Italian delicatessen, which were all very much part of the Yiddish canon, but here it's just kind of been industrialized and whittled down. So I would say, you know, if they should look for culinary inspiration, it should be deeper within that same culture. This gentleman here had his hand up in the center.
I don't think that the delicatessen will totally disappear in the large urban cities.
Not as long as you're alive, sir.
quite true. But I think the changing picture in the Midwest and so forth, in the malls, in the big shopping centers, they now have what they call delicatessen. You know, we from Philadelphia say it's not delicatessen, just like Philly's cheesesteak in some other city is not a Philly cheesesteak. But I think maybe that's what's going to happen, is that the mom-and-pop delicatessens will degenerate into the shopping center things. We were in upstate New York, and one of the big ShopRite opened a delicatessen, and people went crazy because the big Jewish crowds in Saratoga and so forth ran there to get their delicatessen, because there isn't the real delicatessen.
And this is something that's been happening, I mean, literally since the 1950s, when the ShopRites or the Safeways put in their deli counters and they started slicing cold corned beef and cold pastrami for, you know, housewives to take home. That cut into the deli's business, and that really helped kill them off. So that's not necessarily a new phenomenon, and it isn't just in, you know, outside of the cities. It's the same factor is happening within the cities as well.
They don't call it ShopRite's Deli. It's Ben and Jake's Deli,
right,
within the there.
Branded.
They cater to the same clientele.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's, again, a marketing thing and trying to capture a specific audience. But the fact of the matter is, true Jewish deli lovers who go in there, you know, the taste at the end of the day leads the way. And so if you're going to a place which is cutting corners and just, you know, trying to be a concept, it's never going to be as good. Who, you, sir? And then we'll move back up here, and then we're done.
Hi, I'm a deli owner for the last 25 years.
Mrs. Marty's Deli, is
yeah,
it?
Mrs. Marty's Deli,
love
named
it
after my wife.
Pleasure to meet you. You, Mrs. Marty, as well.
I think the Jewish deli will never die, and I think the problem why they're not growing is the generations don't want to work as hard as you have to do in a Jewish deli. I make my own corned beef. I make my own tongue. I make all my own salads, my turkey, my roast beef. We're in Broomall, Pennsylvania, and in Media, I have two. And it's not a Jewish ghetto, but it's the signature stuff that you get known for, and it's the kibitzing you do with the customers that they come back for. So it's not only the food, and I read part of your book already, and my daughter is the one who brought me here tonight, and she's from New York, is to hear what you had to say. And I think I'm looking to open up a third and maybe a fourth one, but it's getting the people who are willing to work the hours and how hard it is. It's the smoked fishes. It's knowing what the Jewish people like to eat and making sure it's the best you can buy, and not getting the pre-sliced lox and not getting the corned beef that was cooked in Ohio or wherever it was cooked and then shipped to you, and all you have to do is slice it. Because
and again, you know, it proves how hard it is, that the way to save the Jewish deli is to bring back quality. And you say it's, you know, that quality, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens with the 15, 16-hour days, and it happens with the types of skilled labor. So,
right,
you know, I applaud you, and everybody here should applaud this gentleman as well. And visit his deli, for God's sakes. You know, cater your son, your grandson's bris at his deli, I beg you. Or your grandfather's Shiva. Are you linked? Oh, you're not linked. We could have consolidated.
What do you see as the influence of the Middle Eastern restaurants, the falafel places, the Iranian places, and the Mideast Jewish cooking having on delis?
You know, the Sephardic population is far smaller, not just in North America, but in the rest of the world. So the impact hasn't been so large for Iranian cooking and Moroccan and other sorts of Sephardic things. The Israeli food, the falafel restaurant, has in a way supplanted the Jewish deli, one, because it's less expensive, two, because it's seen as healthier, and three, for another reason, which is that, you know, young Jews these days are really brought up with a strong Zionist identity. You know, they go to Hebrew school and they're told about Israel and the wonderful country and all this sort of stuff. And Eastern Europe to them is the Holocaust. I mean, that's just what it is. And so they identify psychologically a lot with Israel. They go to a kibbutz when they're 16 and they go on birthright. And, you know, a way for them to recapture that is the falafel place. And so that's, you know, obviously taken some of the business away from the deli, but I think the two things can be complementary. I grew up eating falafel for lunch from the King Falafel near my high school every single day, which was owned by Moroccans, so it was, you know, a wonderful place. Yes, ma'am, next to you. And then this lady over here, and then we'll have a nush.
Part of the problem for those of us who keep kosher is that most of the delis now are not kosher. And so, I know that Famous just opened up here in town, and they're charging like $15 for a sandwich, and it's not kosher. So a lot of us cannot eat at the kosher delis.
It's true. There are several reasons, right? One is that far fewer American Jews are actually kosher, that the numbers of kosher eaters have declined. The kosher food industry has grown, but that's actually to serve more Muslims than Jews. The flip side of this is that the kosher food industry is also and the rabbinical authorities who sort of handle the kosher food industry have caused the industry to be much more expensive and it very difficult for owners to operate. So I told you about the economic factors that make the Jewish deli difficult to run and make a profit in. You know, take all those factors and add in a permanent supervision that you have to pay for every single day, every single hour that the thing's open for $15 an hour or more, plus, you know, the next rabbi, the next community over says, well, you should pay me some money too. All your products are going to be 15 to 20 to 30% more expensive depending on your level of kosher, whether it's, you know, Hebrew National kosher or Glatt kosher. And you have to close Friday night. You have to close Saturday. You have to close not just on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Passover, but Tu B'Shvat and Simchas Torah and Sukkot. You have to close well over 100 and something days a year when you could be making money. And so that's the reason why there aren't that many kosher delicatessens. It's extremely difficult to operate. You're taking a difficult business to operate, and you're making it even more difficult. And it has to serve a narrow community. And here's the thing. A kosher delicatessen is going to serve a kosher community, but if there's a non-kosher deli next to a kosher deli and that $15 sandwich is $18 in the kosher deli, someone who isn't kosher or who isn't Jewish, he doesn't care about keeping kosher, so he'll go to the place that's less expensive. It's very, very difficult, and it's a real shame because they're the bedrocks of the community, and to people who keep kosher, they're more than just a restaurant. They're, you know, their life, their sustenance. They're in several communities, like this one Jewish deli in New Orleans called the Kosher Cajun. They're the sole source for kosher food for the entire Gulf Coast, you know, basically all the way to Houston and up to down pretty much for a lot of Florida and up into a lot of Alabama. I mean, that's the only thing. So it's very sad but, you know, incredibly difficult. Next question was the gentleman next to you. Oh, no. The lady right in front. Lady right in front. Then the lady in the back has been waiting so patiently.
Hi, it's Ellen. Those places that just get like National Brand Pastrami or Hebrew National, I call those slicer joints. And that's why it's not going to taste the same most of the case. Like you said, they're not making it from scratch. And a lot of places like Atman's in Baltimore, they're actually adjusting to the changing demographics. Most of the people aren't even Jewish that go in anymore, but it's working. Those people aren't even as fussy. They're saying it's great. They just want a good corned beef. They're not saying make it lean, do this, do that. They're just, you know, whoever's in the neighborhood's going in there, it's working for them. And the third thing I was going to say is I heard that you actually lost weight when you were running around the last few years going to those delis, right? You said you lost weight.
I didn't gain that, you know, I might have lost a pound or so, but exactly. I didn't balloon and I'm still somewhat alive, I think, unless I keel over at the end of this. There's something healthy. Well, this is, you know, the majority of this is food that's made fresh and from scratch if it's done right without a lot of preservatives and, you know, without crazy processes. I mean, you know, a stuffed cabbage is just cabbage and ground beef and other ingredients and stewed in a tomato sauce. I mean, it's, you know, wholesome, hearty food. And so you shouldn't fear it. Ma'am, who's been waiting so patiently, just the microphone's coming.
I don't know if it'll make sense exactly, but when talking about what will make the help delis survive, You have newer places. I'm thinking at the moment like a place like Pumpernick's that we have now. But in general, it seems to me that the ones that are surviving have a combination. You come in and you usually have to pass the deli counter where it's sold and it smells and you get the flavor and you get the spiel and et cetera before you even get to sit down. Then when you sit down, you can order, certainly, and if you're at a good place where they really make the good corned beef, et cetera. But you can also order healthy food. You can certainly order fish and vegetables, and you can have chicken. And also the fact that because they're not glatt kosher, only kosher style, you can be sitting at the same table with somebody who has lox and bagel, and you can have your corned beef, and somebody else has fish and vegetables. So you have a variety. So I notice when we go to these places, you don't have just a Jewish crowd, but you do have people who appreciate it.
Of course. The fact of the matter is a delicatessen, a Jewish delicatessen that relies on an entirely Jewish crowd would pretty much go out of business. Just like any other restaurant, we're too small a population. And why should we keep it to ourselves? I mean, I've been to Jewish delis in Detroit where 95% of the clientele is black, and they do fantastically well. And there's no reason why, you know, we should look down upon a deli that doesn't serve a majority Jewish clientele. The only time when that sort of falls away is when the other clientele is saying, well, I think you should also have, you know, this, and this. I mean, Junior's Delicatessen in New York, the famous cheesecake place, a sort of classic deli, which as the downtown Brooklyn changed, the majority of the clientele is African-American. If you go in on a Sunday morning, you get Sunday lunch, you get the after-church crowd, and it's 99% black, and the menu changed to reflect that. So it's now a lot of Southern barbecue and fried chicken and those sorts of Southern African-American foods, and there's very little Jewish deli on the menu. And so most people say, you know, Junior's isn't a deli anymore. It sells a lot of cheesecake. They do it a lot sort of wholesale and whatnot, but you still can serve diverse populations without sacrificing your culinary and cultural integrity, and it's a difficult balance, but that, I think, is what needs to be done. So there is a nosh. Where's the nosh, the food? Out downstairs? Upstairs in the lobby. We have pastrami from Herschel's East Side Deli in the market, and other goods from Rachel's Nosherai, I believe. So thank you very much. I'll be selling books upstairs and signing them. And, Eskazint.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.